Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic, I-17 southbound, a crash on the Camelback Road exit ramp. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a forecast high of 88 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows in the upper 50s. Partly sunny 84 tomorrow, then down to 71 for a high on Thursday. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 84 degrees. Republican Helen Purcell has conceded the race for county recorder to Democratic challenger Adrian Fontes. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the elected position oversees county elections. It also records official documents like real estate transactions.
While there are still thousands of mail-in and provisional ballots left to be counted, Purcell, the incumbent, issued a statement Tuesday congratulating Fontes on the unofficial win. She also thanked county voters for the opportunity to work as the county recorder for 28 years, adding, quote, "There's no greater joy than seeing such high turnout and participation." County officials are reporting that Fontes is leading Purcell by almost 13,000 votes. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
More than 1,400 early ballots in Maricopa County won't be counted because election officials think the signature on the ballot doesn't match the signature on file. And as KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reports, not all of those voters were alerted there was an issue.
The Arizona Elections Procedures Manual says the county recorder must make a reasonable and meaningful attempt to contact a voter if the signature doesn't match. In Maricopa County, elections officials called these voters leading up to November 8th, and ballots were counted if voters verified their identities. But voters who dropped off early ballots with problematic signatures on Election Day likely weren't warned before their ballots were disqualified. Spencer Scharf of the Arizona Democratic Party says that's a violation of elections procedures.
Thus, we strongly urge officials in Maricopa County to implement their full verification process to all early ballots, including those received on Election Day.
In Pima County, elections officials contacted all voters with mismatched signatures and gave them until last Friday to verify their identities. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Coyotes plan to leave Glendale and head east to Tempe. They've unveiled a plan for a 16,000-seat arena on the site of ASU's Carson Golf Course in Tempe. The project would also include a multi-sport arena for the university. The Coyotes and Glendale have been at odds for a while now, and the team has talked openly about looking for another place to play. With me to talk about this is Robert Height. He's the president and CEO of the Glendale Chamber of Commerce. And Robert, first off, what's your initial reaction to the news of the Coyotes maybe leaving town?
I guess I don't have an initial reaction, given what's transpired over the past several months and year. I mean, the Coyotes have expressed their desire to pursue opportunities out there that might align with their franchise. So I don't know that this would come as a direct surprise, given that Anthony and the Coyotes have said that they're exploring options. They're out there looking at what else can be.
Given that, as you say, this is not such a surprise to you, has the Chamber or have Glendale businesses been doing anything? Is there anything to do to try to potentially sort of soften the blow of this?
You know, we as a Chamber are very fortunate. We've had a wonderful relationship with the Arizona Coyotes. I think by and large, the majority of the fans, that are, the hockey fans, they're going to support the Coyotes. Business folks do. I think, like many, we hear about it when it hits the airwaves or the social media channels, and it's the water cooler chatter, if you will. But then I think the reality is a lot of these business owners get back into their day-to-day routine of providing the products and services that they offer, and it's not quite forgotten about, but it's not top of mind. And I think that's probably the case here.
From a financial and an economic standpoint, do you think this potential move will impact Glendale in any appreciable way?
You know, I always say we're better off to have, and as a chamber, I mean, like I said, we have a phenomenal relationship. We're better off to have an organization like the Coyotes or any, you know, major league sports. I think a city, it adds to the character, the vitality of a city. So sure, would there be an impact if they go? Absolutely. But what's most important is, if the Coyotes are going to relocate, is us as a chamber and a city reassuring our businesses that we have a concentrated effort on our Westgate Area Entertainment District. The chamber, our economic development department, the city, you know, we're working very closely around what economic development opportunities either exist, could exist, or what we need to do to make sure that we're attracting, you know, a number of different industry segments into the area that could possibly offset the number of game days.
Have you heard from any of your members at Westgate about this?
You know, the Westgate businesses, you know, of course, they're all huge proponents of the Coyotes, and probably very much concerned, you know, on different days at different magnitudes based on what they either hear or see, and rightfully so. And again, if the Coyotes do strike a deal, because again, they're just in a negotiating stage and at a very early stage with the partners there. If that does come to fruition and they go, you know, that's where what we take very seriously as a chamber, and again, working in collaboration with our city about outlining the plan around economic development in that area. So they're not forgotten about. They're not off the radar. They're just as much a part of the conversation every single day as, you know, if the Coyotes leave, because those businesses are part of the fabric of our community. So we care just as much about them as we do the Coyotes and many of our other great partners.
Robert Hyde is president and CEO of the Glendale Chamber of Commerce. The Coyotes' departure would also have impacts beyond just that city. For more on that, I'm joined by Cintra Hoffman, president and CEO of Westmark, the Western Maricopa Coalition. And Cintra, what kind of impact would the team leaving have on both Glendale and the West Valley overall?
Well, certainly there's a said number of game nights that happen, and there would be an impact on those nights in that area. However, I think Westgate is a tremendous asset as a whole, as an entertainment center, that there would be an opportunity for other businesses to still continue to do well in that area, despite the potential loss of the Coyotes.
Irrespective of the potential economic and financial impact, is there more of like a perception or sort of civic pride impact of having a team leave one part of town for another?
Well, you know, certainly there's always the concern. We want to keep our sports teams in our region. I think we're all pretty successful in having a strong relationship. The Coyotes is a member of Westmark, as well as the Cardinals and several of the other teams in this area. And I think one of the things that we pride ourselves in the West Valley on is the sports and recreation opportunities that we have to provide not only to our West Valley residents, but other residents in the region, and to bring them to this area. So, you know, certainly, we absolutely in every which way do not want to see the Coyotes leave. That would be a loss of their presence. However, I think a lot of the teams, it's no secret that they are making other business decisions that they've been working on for with other deals, and they're trying to get other things going amongst themselves. So I think what we've been doing in that respect is working with our local economic development departments and our local chambers to make sure that we're coming up with the appropriate business strategy to supplement those losses. And again, you know, hoping that the Coyotes will not leave. They have a strong fan base in the West Valley, and they have strong relationships within the business organizations here.
Do you think that the Coyotes' departure would have any kind of impact on yours and other groups' ability to recruit businesses to the West Valley, or tourists or residents to that part of town?
I think, you know, in terms of tourists, sure, it's going to have its impact. We would obviously see the hockey fans going to a different part of the region. But I think in terms of business recruitment, no, absolutely not. Our top industries in the West Valley are healthcare, advanced businesses, and advanced manufacturing. I think no matter what, we're still going to pull those types of companies because they rely, they make business decisions based on workforce, and we have a very strong and educated workforce in the West Valley. So I think in terms of business recruitment, it doesn't come down to a sports facility. It comes down to the workforce needs, and our challenge and our goal is to make sure that we're educating the rest of the region and the businesses, potential businesses, on the asset of workforce that we have here today.
Cintra Hoffman is the president and CEO of Westmark. We were talking about the Arizona Coyotes' potential move from Glendale to Tempe.
The vote in Glendale on Monday afternoon was close, but the city council approved spending millions of dollars to settle a legal claim over parking at University of Phoenix Stadium. KJZZ's Matthew Casey has been covering this story, and he joins me. And Matt, the city basically admitted it violated its contract to provide parking for the stadium. The Cardinals and the Arizona Sports and Tourism Authority filed a notice of claim for about $67 million. How does this settlement compare with that figure?
Well, Mark, it looks like the settlement will be less than the notice of claim. Glendale will pay about $14 million in damages, and adding two parking lots will cost the city about $37.5 million. All of that adds up to about $51.6 million, but the city also agreed to build out 95th Avenue, and so far there's been no dollar amount attached to that project.
Now, Matt, the settlement also calls for Glendale to pay roughly $3 million for pedestrian infrastructure. What exactly is that?
So, Glendale had looked at building a parking garage at Westgate to solve this legal claim. Instead, it bought a couple pieces of land last year to turn into parking lots. One of those lots is south of the stadium, and the $3 million will go toward a bridge and underpass to connect the lot with the stadium. Here's Cardinals president Michael Bidwill.
The stadium was originally designed to have most of the parking coming from the north side of the stadium, and now with this change, most of the parking is going to be coming from south of Maryland Avenue. And so if you think about it with your own house, you know, if you were to take the garage off one side and move it to the other side of the house, it costs a lot of money.
So Matt, why exactly did Glendale settle now?
City manager Kevin Phelps has focused on ending disputes since he took over this year. The city paid legal fees to the Glendale Airport Pilots Association and ended a lawsuit. It also ceased litigation with the company Conair, which Phelps says is now expanding and will become the second largest development in Maricopa County. Phelps has been pushing development of a long-term strategic plan for the city, something he says will help end a cycle of crisis governing. Here's how Phelps says settling the parking issue plays into that plan.
At the end of the day, we wanted to form a relationship with the Arizona Cardinals. It's one of our most visible brands in the entire state of Arizona. We want to get engaged with them in a way that we can leverage their resources, their expertise, their ability to make things happen.
That's Glendale City Manager Kevin Phelps. Matt, this was a 4-3 vote before the Glendale City Council last night. For the council members who did not support this settlement, what reasons do they give for that?
Well, they had a variety of reasons. In fact, every council member, whether they voted for or against it, explained their vote before they cast it. For the folks who voted against it, they all mentioned the decision to post the proposed settlement the day before a holiday weekend, and that some of them had concerns about transparency and whether or not the public had enough time to review the proposal.
That's Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
The day after Donald Trump won the presidential race, more than 100,000 people signed up for health care through the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. But the rising cost of buying health insurance on the marketplace, with fewer providers offering it, has put many, including small businesses, in a tough spot. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with the Arizona Small Business Association about this, and she joins me. So, Lauren, the Arizona Small Business Association, or ASBA, used to offer health insurance plans to its members, right?
Yes, that's actually why they were originally formed. But when the Affordable Care Act passed, Cigna, their provider, decided they didn't need to provide the plan anymore because now everyone would have access to health insurance. Carol Mangan, their director of member benefits, said that ASBA actually lost a lot of their members then. And ASBA is holding a forum on healthcare for their members today to talk about what options small business owners have now, as well as looking forward to what healthcare could look like under the Trump administration. And I started by asking her if she hears from business owners often about their concerns over healthcare.
Every day, all the time. What they're finding is they're paying much higher premiums with much less coverage, and it's becoming quite priced pretty much out of the market.
Right. So explain that to me. How does the Affordable Care Act work for small business owners?
It works just if it's a group as small as one. There are no carriers that are willing to consider that as a group. So you have to be at least two employees, payroll employees, to be part of a group.
Okay. And so the result of that is that essentially most of your small business members are on an individual plan like anyone else?
So many of our organizations are mom and pop organizations, or they're a sole proprietor. They're attorneys, they're accountants, they're small businesses. And many times it's just one person running the business, or it's a husband and wife. And so they would not be considered a group. They would actually be considered individuals.
You said you get questions like this a lot. And what do you think the best solutions are that you can offer your members in terms of how they can figure out their coverage for at least the coming year?
Well, a couple things. If it makes financial sense to start a group offering within their organization, that's a great idea, because if they have at least two employees, they do qualify for group, which many times they can get somewhat better rights or at least better choices. They might just have to bite the bullet for this year and take a look at what's in the market until something does change.
And you mentioned that you will try to talk about on Tuesday the idea that things could really change in light of our election. Can you talk a little bit about what you might be able to tell your members at this point?
You know, it's anybody's guess what will actually happen. It's one thing to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It's another thing in terms of what do you replace it with. It's a question that's on everybody's mind.
Yeah. And so there are also some parts of the Affordable Care Act that people seem to be very in favor of. Have your members talked about those?
Oh, definitely. So what you've got is they're not considering pre-existing conditions, so that's one thing. You have dependent coverage up to 26, which is a very good thing. And another thing is there's no limits on the high side in case there's a catastrophic incident.
So with those things, even though the rates have gone up and the premiums are tough and the options are slimming at this point, as a leader in the business community and in the small business community, what do you hope comes out of a potential repeal of the ACA and replacement?
Well, probably more choice. It does appear that we're moving towards a more managed care environment because costs are high for everyone. You know, they're high in terms of the hospitals, they're the providers, the carriers, the individuals. So everybody's really sharing the burden here. And I think we have to take a look at the responsibilities across the board and more involvement.
At this point, though, all we can say with some certainty, I think, is that odds are you will still have the same plan you enroll in now through 2017. Is it a tough spot to be in the business community right now because you don't know what could happen next?
Absolutely. I think it's difficult for all of us. We're a small business as well, so we have the same concerns that our small businesses have.
And ASPA's forum is sponsored by Aetna and Banner, which recently merged, and they plan to offer coverage plans to small businesses.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. With the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Change is coming under a new presidential administration, whether it's cutting taxes, changing U.S. foreign policy, erasing the Obama legacy. We're looking at what institutions will get the most serious Trump treatment over the next 4 years. One of those institutions is the United States Supreme Court.
Donald B. Verrilli is an attorney with Munger, Tolles, and Olson. He's served for 5 years as Solicitor General under the Obama administration on major legal issues like marriage equality and the Affordable Care Act. He believes the Supreme Court has already been sullied from being dragged into one political battle after another over the past two decades. He's worried that if Trump gets three or more appointments, the court may be unrecoverable as a neutral authority on the U.S. law of the land.
Now, the court is not, in fact, a political institution. They don't make their decisions for partisan reasons. But I have a grave concern now that the court is going to be perceived by the public as just another partisan institution. And the reason I think that is because of what happened with the Republican obstructionism in denying Merrick Garland a seat on the court and now transferring the ability to nominate the person to fill the empty seat to President Trump.
And where do you think the Trump court would be headed if he has the opportunity to appoint as many as three justices over the next 4 years?
I think the right way to think about it is to take it one step at a time. President Trump will nominate a person to succeed Justice Scalia. And I don't think that that is going to bring about a major convulsive change of any kind. What you'll basically have, at least in the immediate future, will be a court that looks very much like the court that we had for the last 5 years. And that's a court that upheld the Affordable Care Act twice and recognized marriage equality and protected a woman's constitutional right to reproductive choice. It's also a court, of course, that struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and a court that gave no constitutional scrutiny of any kind to voter ID laws. So in the immediate future, I don't think there's going to be a dramatic change. The question, of course, will be whether any other justices step down. And that's the moment at which there could really be significant change in the direction of the court.
Donald Trump seemed to suggest that gay marriage is settled. Does that mean no court would go back and overturn that decision?
Well, I don't think everything is up for grabs immediately. And I think the marriage equality decision, it will remain the law of the land for the foreseeable future. But I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that if there is a significant change in the court, that that issue wouldn't be revisited. All of us understand, with any perspective on history, that progress isn't linear, that it's often two steps forward, one step back. And so I think it would be unwise to assume that a decision like the Obergefell marriage equality decision is solid and sound for all time.
You say that the appointment of a justice to replace the late Justice Scalia won't have any convulsive effect on the court. But I'm wondering if the supposition that we suddenly have changed it from appointing judicial scholars or people who can be experts on the Constitution to filling particular slots that represent political ideologies. I mean, that's the whole bit right there.
That's the concern. I agree with you. Candidate Trump and now President Trump has said he intends to nominate somebody in the mold of Justice Scalia. So I think that's what we can expect. Now, I'm sure that person will be a person of integrity and a person of great intellect. But I do think that the partisan maneuvering was certainly done for the express purpose of achieving just what you described, getting somebody in there who would vote in the way that the Republican senators wanted the justice to vote.
Who trusts the court now and who doesn't trust the court right now?
So, you know, I think the professional class will continue to trust the court because the people who appear in front of it and the people who work as lawyers in our judicial system do recognize that it's not, in fact, a partisan institution, and they do their best to make judgments based on their view of the law. I think the problem is that the public is going to perceive it that way because they're watching what's happened here. They're watching how this seat wasn't filled during the Obama administration, and it's instead going to be filled by President Trump's choice. And I think the general public is going to increasingly come to the view that this is just another political institution. It's not an institution devoted to the law.
The Obama administration has looked at the segregation in housing in America as being an alarming degree of separation of the races, and they're not the only ones who have done that. If there are attempts to enforce the Fair Housing Act and to try to reverse that segregation, do you see a Trump court essentially stopping that and enshrining the level of segregation that we have right now as a kind of states' rights issue that, okay, it's all right that we have this level of segregation?
Just last year, or year before last, I guess, the Supreme Court did uphold the ability to enforce the Fair Housing Act vigorously in a case in which the United States participated and I argued. And that was a court that had Justice Scalia on it. But I will say that is another issue in which if there is a significant change in the personnel of the court, if there are two or three new appointments, then I think the ability to vigorously enforce the Fair Housing Act is something that I think could genuinely be at risk.
And then de facto, the court will have enshrined a segregated America as appropriate and legal and essentially consistent with the Constitution.
Well, what it will have done, I guess, is disabled the ability of government and the ability of private citizens who have been wronged to use the rule of law to remedy that problem. And that's a pretty terrible consequence.
Donald B. Verrilli is former Solicitor General of the United States. He spoke to us from San Francisco. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Lots of organizations are looking at their work and how it may change under the new administration once President-elect Trump takes office in January. One of them is the Sonoran Institute. After Election Day, CEO Stephanie Sklar wrote the 2016 presidential election makes her group's work more relevant than ever. Sklar joins me now. And Stephanie, I'm curious if you think the kinds of issues you work on got enough attention from any of the candidates during the election.
I have to admit that I was frustrated in the early going of the election because I really didn't hear very much about environmental issues, especially climate change, which is an issue that is extremely important to the younger generation. And it really wasn't until further along in the debates, towards the end of the debates and the end of the political season, where it even really became an issue. So yes, that was very frustrating.
Do you take anything from that into what you might expect from President-elect Trump once he takes office?
I think that he really hasn't fully formulated his opinions on climate change and the environment. And I think that his initial reaction was to appoint a climate denier, of which there really aren't very many left, to lead the transition team for the EPA, but he's also made some better decisions about who's going to lead the transition for Interior and other agencies. So certainly he has talked about bringing coal back. I don't really think that's going to happen. It's not really practical, but it certainly will, I think, mean doom for the President Obama's Clean Power Plan, as an example.
Are there particular clues that you're looking for from the incoming administration to try to sort of read the tea leaves as to where it might stand on particular issues that are of importance to you?
Well, I think that there's a lot of unpredictability about what is actually going to be a priority and what is going to happen. I think from the scope of all of the measures and initiatives that President-elect and his team have been talking about as their imminent priorities, the environment is probably not going to be the first thing that they focus on in any direction, positive, negative, or neutral. I think that the EPA will definitely, they'll be taking a big look at the EPA, but there's still a lot of international energy around alternative energy, climate change, drought, flooding, and these are community-driven. The communities have to address these regardless of what the administration does. So it's just hard to know.
Do you think that it would be an advantage or a disadvantage to Sonoran Institute and other groups who do what you do that the environment might not be on the front burner for this new administration right away?
I think that it could go either way because there are certain things that have to be paid attention to, like the climate agreement, the International Climate Accord. But I also think that it does give all of groups like ours a chance to take a deep breath, continue the work, and see how things shake out without being too reactionary. So, you know, sometimes bad is good, and sometimes change can be taken either way. And so we just don't know, but we're, as I say, we're going to look at it as an opportunity to build new bridges, make new relationships, and continue to do the work which we think is critically important to Western communities.
Stephanie Sklar is the CEO of the Sonoran Institute. Stephanie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
In a check of KJZZ News at 2:38, the Arizona Attorney General is agreeing with a Southern Arizona lawmaker in saying Tucson may be breaking state law by destroying guns that have been turned over to police. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports.
In his report, Attorney General Mark Brnovich agreed with a complaint filed by State Representative Mark Fincham that by destroying the guns, the city ordinance may violate one or more state laws. Fincham filed the complaint in October, stating that Tucson is violating a 2013 Arizona law requiring the sale of otherwise legal guns obtained by law enforcement agencies. Tucson officials argue destroying firearms is legal because it is a local issue involving municipal property. Brnovich did not indicate in his report whether he will pursue any further legal action. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
In a check of international news, Britain's decision to leave the European Union will have a profound effect on the UK's relationship with Ireland. One obvious question is what sort of border will exist between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Trade between the two accounts for up to $1.1 billion a week, so what effect will Brexit have on that? The BBC's Alan Little reports on politicians discussing the implications of Brexit for the island.
The border between Northern Ireland and the Republic was drawn in the 1920s. For half a century, there were customs controls, border posts to regulate the flow of goods between North and South. They were swept away when the two countries entered the European Community together in 1973.
You can drive down this road without even noticing that you've left one country and entered another. But soon, this will be the edge of the European Union. Down there, migrants from 26 other countries will still be able to come and live and work and claim benefits, but not if they walk up there into the United Kingdom. If you have no border controls here, how do you police that?
The same applies to trade in goods. How will the EU monitor and control the flow of British goods into the single market across this border? Northern Ireland's biggest party, the Democratic Unionists, campaigned for Brexit. At their conference at the weekend, their emphatic British unionism seemed invigorated by their sense that a lost UK sovereignty had been seized back by the referendum. They believe these as yet unanswered border questions are merely technical challenges, and that with political will, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic will remain all but invisible. Gavin Robinson is the MP for Belfast East.
With the political willingness from both the British and Irish government privately that they would never see a return to borders of the past, and we're actually quite relaxed about it. We're not ignoring the fact that there are issues that need to be worked through, but they are entirely surmountable, and we will work through them.
In the Republic, they do not share this sunny optimism, for they know that one way of avoiding a hard border across the island of Ireland is for the Republic to bow to the reality of geography and allow the UK to move its own border controls out, away from the land crossing and into Ireland's own international ports of entry. The UK border authorities thus working in and through Ireland's own structures. The journalist and commentator Fintan O'Toole believes this could resurrect post-colonial animosities that Ireland and Britain alike had believed they had consigned to history.
You're asking for an independent state, the Republic of Ireland, to impose and work British migration law at its ports and airports. I mean, that's really what you're saying, which is kind of saying, well, we don't really think you're an independent country. You know, it's just a kind of a figment of history that's been invented. I think as an Irish person, you feel pretty angry about the fact that something really profound has been done to Ireland without Ireland having featured at all in the discussion.
For decades, it was Britain that looked on in dismay at an Ireland convulsed by questions of sovereignty and identity. Today, Ireland has a strong, modern character as an independent nation-state embedded in Europe. But its destiny is still shaped by events in Britain, events over which it has little control and which still exert a powerful gravitational pull.
That's the BBC's Alan Little in Ireland. Immigration advocates across the country are preparing for what they call a great unknown. That is, will President-elect Donald Trump carry through with his campaign promises of mass deportations once he's in office? From Tucson, Nancy Montoya reports.
Over the past 17 months, Donald Trump made a crackdown on illegal immigration and the border with Mexico a centerpiece of his presidential campaign. He vowed to revoke President Barack Obama's executive order allowing Dreamers to remain legally in the U.S. In Arizona, that would affect more than 20,000 registered undocumented immigrants under the age of 30. They've been granted temporary protection from deportation.
Definitely, there are going to be devastating losses for the immigrant community. I mean, there's no way of sugarcoating that.
That's Lynn Marcus, who co-directs the Immigration Law Clinic at the University of Arizona College of Law.
I mean, we expect that there will be more detention, that there will be more efforts to, you know, deport people, maybe more raids.
And that's the biggest fear facing young immigrants who were granted protection under President Obama's Deferred Action Executive Order.
There's a lot of depression and anxiety.
Before Tuesday, 20-year-old Guillermo was a dreamer filled with hope. Today, he says, those hopes have vanished. His mother brought him from Mexico to the U.S. at age 5. He and others like him are called dreamers after a piece of proposed federal legislation called the DREAM Act that would give them legal status. Guillermo graduated from high school in Tucson and is a junior at the University of Arizona. He says he and others like him have no choice but to once again hide in the shadows.
Due to either being denied the right to move forward with their lives or being scared that they're going to be deported or their family's going to be deported.
It's why he asked that we use only his first name and why other dreamers declined to speak with us, either on or off the record. One said a group of them will be meeting later this week to discuss any other options they have. This was not just another election. This was an event that he fears will alter the course and the quality of his life.
Well, I'm back to a state of uncertainty.
Lynn Marcus of the Immigration Law Center says that's an understandable feeling, considering what his temporary status means.
To be granted dreamer status, they had to come out of the shadows. They had to give an address. They had to give contact information. All of that information now is in the hands of the government. And the fears of many dreamers is that now this information will be used in order to round them up.
People who are already dreamers, who have already come forward, they should renew their applications now. The Obama administration will process those applications now, and that still enables people to, you know, work for the time being.
But for the long term, Marcus says, the fight for comprehensive immigration reform, especially for dreamers, is not over.
There's a large sympathy in the country for people who were brought here as children and are contributing to the community, so that, you know, despite all kinds of things that Donald Trump has said, it remains to be seen what he's actually going to do.
The words offer little comfort to Guillermo, who's having trouble seeing where to from here. He looks ahead and says again, there is only uncertainty.
Right now, I'm just huddling with my friends so that we make it through.
In Tucson, I'm Nancy Montoya.
There were a few organizations that were key in helping raise the Latino vote in this last election. The show's Naomi Gingold joins me to talk about one of those groups.
Yeah, so I spoke to Tony Valdovinos. He's the executive director of La Machine. It's an organization that works to increase civic participation, especially among millennials. And Valdovinos has an interesting backstory. He's 26. He grew up here in Arizona, but he found out when he was 18 that he actually was undocumented. So he couldn't join the military, he couldn't run for office, and instead he created this organization to help spur others into action and create a new generation of Latino leaders. So I asked him at first, you know, how he felt about the results of the election.
Well, we feel very successful. Our primary objective this year was to defeat Arpaio. It's been a really long road. I think a lot of organizations focused on this effort, and here we are. We defeat Joe Arpaio here in Arizona. And Donald Trump is elected to the presidency. And Donald Trump called Joe Arpaio his political soulmate. You know, it's just, it's 2016, and we just showed the entire world and our children, our little brothers and sisters, that the United States wasn't ready for a progressive woman.
What are the other races that you guys were following and that you guys were directly trying to influence the outcome of?
This year, I think in the general, we decided to focus more on turnout instead of being part of any particular race.
Like you have in the past.
Right. And that's where we decided that we wanted to do more educational work out there in the neighborhoods. You know, every campaign talks about the Latino vote, expanding the electorate. But the reality is, in any strategic competitive campaign, if you try and turn out people who don't regularly turn out to vote, it's a suicide mission because you need to talk to the base first and then try and expand. And so we kind of did a gear switch where we're out there with voter guides. So
basically what you're saying is that you took a much more long view approach. You were like, I'm going to kind of create a civic consciousness that will then get people to vote on their own.
Right. And for us, it was, we talked about what was the issues. And anytime I've knocked on a door and somebody's like, oh, yeah, I did get the ballot, but I have no idea what any of this is. And, you know, you crack it open and you're like, well, this seat does this, or this is what that's responsible for. People are listening.
You know, considering the demographics of our area, what we're like 40% plus Latino. The school district in Phoenix is 80-some percent Latino. Is there a crop of, you know, even more young Latinos who are like leaders who are on the horizon that we should be aware of?
Absolutely. And it's an interesting question because the surface level of Latino leadership is people like Ruben Gallego, people like Lucy Flores, like Ray Martinez, people like Isela Blanco, people who are the elected leaders currently. But you have the workforce behind all of these new elected leaders, which are organizations and activists that have been fighting for years to increase the base, to register people to vote. You know, we just have a ton of students that have built organizations from the ground up. For myself, I got into the campaign world right after school became more expensive. And here we are 5 years later, we've elected a ton of fantastic people. We also have this organization that is focused on bringing 17-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds into the political mix of understanding what's going on and not to just kind of coast. It's like, be active, be aware, be part of the process. To us, the essence of progress is to elect younger, brighter thinkers. And it's also been also by equaling the playing field of electing more women.
As you said, you are an undocumented.
Our slang word is documented, which is, you know, I have a social security, I have a driver's license. It's just every 2 years I have to reapply, asking for permission to stay.
This is the DACA program that Obama put in place by executive order.
That's correct.
So how are you feeling right now, knowing that that might disappear in smoke?
I think we're going to have to see what happens. I think a lot of people are freaking out about this program being dismantled, but it's almost like it's not caring. It's like, what can we possibly do right now? I'm not sure what we're going to do. And so, you know, I texted my congressman, you know, my friend, one of my personal idols, and I'm like, hey, what do we do? And he just texted me back. He's like, we fight. And for me, it's like, well, how? Like, what does fighting look like now? I'm not sure. I don't know. But to the question is like, how do we fight? Is that people are going to get more unified. You know, there's been a lot of protests, but protests are very, you know, short. What really gets it work done is when we elect folks, when we influence policy, when we submit policy, when we are active with City Hall, when we're active with the State House, when we're active with Congress. And so I don't know the answer to that question. And right now we're in protection mode. We have to protect people. We have to protect policies. And we have to go on the offensive, you know, when we have the top of the hill that is now being assembled with people who are openly racist.
Tony Valdovinos from La Machine, thank you very much for talking to me.
Awesome, thank you.
And that was the show's Naomi Gingold. Naomi, thanks.
Thank you.
All
A large collection of posters advertising Western and American Indian movies is coming to Arizona. ASU, along with Scottsdale's Museum of the West, has acquired the Strickland Collection, which consists of around 5,000 items, mostly movie posters and lobby cards. With me to talk about this is Peter Lehman, director of ASU Center for Film, Media, and Popular Culture. And Peter, what's the significance of this collection?
It's very significant because there's a great deal of material from what we call early cinema, including the silent period. And in many cases, the films have been lost to us. And all that we have, in some cases, is the posters.
What are some of those movies that are sort of lost to history, but you still have the posters to remember them by and learn from?
Well, you'd be shocked. Probably film historians estimate over 75% of all the silent films that have been made are lost to film history. And they're never going to be found. The percentage will never be significantly changed.
What do these pieces tell us about the movies that were made, that they represent, and what do they tell us maybe about the time in which the movies were made?
The way that movies were advertised at the time that they're released, and it continues now, the marketing tells us about how the audience is thinking about the things that are that the film deals with. So that could include images of Native Americans, for example, in Westerns, images of Hispanics in Westerns, things like that, some of which are very, very important to our current moment.
Are any of these posters ones that, if they were shown today, would be seen as not politically correct?
Yes, but we have to be careful with that. With that term, there's a very interesting film in the collection called Redskin. It was made in 1929, and it's very important to film history and to Arizona for three reasons. It was made in the late silent era in a two-color Technicolor process, very unusual. It's the first film made in Canyon de Chelly, which is became a very important location and tourist site in Arizona. They built the road there for the film. And it used some of the local tribes, and it deals, among other things, with the Indian school movement. And the term Redskin, which was then a derogatory term, is used within the film in a way that brings attention to what you're talking about, brings attention to the fact that that was a slur and created problems for Native Americans being thought of that way.
How have you seen Native Americans portrayed in film from the time of some of these early posters and some of the early movies up until, I noticed that Dancing with Wolves was one of the posters, right, that's in this collection. So how have these folks been portrayed in movies over that time?
That's a very complex question. But I think one of the things is it's not as simple as most people think of going from bad to good. And Redskin is a perfect example, because in the early cinema, there was frequently a great deal of sympathy for the plight of Native Americans, and they were not seen in ways of savagery like they were in many early sound films, for example. So we have to resist simple generalizations.
What do you expect to learn from going through and seeing and having other people see this exhibit?
I think the general public will learn in a great deal about the genre, which they know little or nothing about. And Arizona is maybe the most important state in terms of not only a lot of location shooting, but in terms of its being represented in the films. The Arizona of the West is crucial to the history of the Western genre. And I think scholars and students will learn a great deal about films that, in some cases, that they'll never be able to see, but in some cases, learning how films were marketed at the time tells us much about what they meant that we cannot learn just from watching the movies.
Peter Lehman is the director of the ASU Center for Film, Media, and Popular Culture. We were talking about the acquisition by ASU and Scottsdale's Museum of the West of the Strickland Collection of Western and Indian movie posters. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.